The following episode is from 2006.
Hi, I'm Mary McPartland. My guest today on Piano Jazz is Nat Hentoff, famous jazz historian and newly appointed jazz advocate by the National Endowment for the Arts. Congratulations.
Well, fortunately, when they appointed me, they didn't ask me to play anything.
But isn't that sort of exciting to you?
I was just astonished because I owe so much to you and all these other musicians because, you know, years ago I was talking to Merle Haggard, who knows a lot about jazz. He's known as a country player and singer. And he was saying that when things get way down and nothing else can lift him up, it's music. And that's what jazz keeps doing for me and has done all my life. So to be among you people, and I can't even play, that was a great surprise.
Well, I think it's very deserving because you've done so much for the music. It seems like all your life. I mean, I've known you for I don't know how many years, but you've always been involved in music. I think one of the first things I remember is when George Wein had Storyville in Boston.
Right.
And you were at that time, I think you were on WMEX.
You got a good memory, yeah.
And you were also doubling as an MC because I was doing something, I think, with Jimmy.
Yeah.
And I remember you, it's on a record. They made a record. You called me Marion Page McPartland. I finally got rid of the Page. That was when I found out there was a Marion Page in New York who played at the Monkey Bar.
Oh.
So that's when I became Marion McPartland.
I see. I remember you when I came to New York at the Hickory House with that bar over the stand over the bar. And when he was in town, which wasn't often, Duke Ellington was sitting there listening.
Duke was wonderful. He would get up and play once in a while.
Yeah.
And Joe Morgan, of course, his press agent, would interfere and get in the way.
His devoted press agent, yeah.
Well,
he felt he was protecting Duke at all times.
Yeah, I guess he did. That was probably what he thought. You must have started listening to jazz as a young kid.
I remember the day. I was 11 years old. I was walking down the main street in Boston, Washington Street, and in those days, the record stores had PA systems, so this music came out on the street, and I got so excited, I shouted, which you didn't do in Boston in those days. And I ran into the record shop, and I said, "What was that?" "Oh, that's Artie Shaw's Nightmare." And that started me. And this was the Depression, so I was working. I worked on a fruit wagon and other things, so I'd later go to record stores, and you could buy 3 Billie Holidays or a Holiday and a Basie and Howlin' Wolf for a dollar, and that started me in, and I've never stopped.
That's amazing. And of all things, to have Artie Shaw's Nightmare get you started.
Well, there was the music that first reached me inside deeply when I was a kid was cantorial music in the Orthodox synagogues because the cantors, the chazans, improvised. And they sang with a great deal of passion as they were arguing with God. But years later, I found out that Artie Shaw had taken the theme out of a cantorial, they used to call them niggins, those were melodies, and that formed the basis of Nightmare. I didn't realize the connection.
Of all kinds of tunes to use for your theme song, Nightmare, I could play that for you.
I wish you would, because that brings me back to when I was 11 years old.
Okay, I'll do it.
Thank you.
I tell you, hearing that again, the way you played it with the kind of intensity and the passion that Artie had in the music. You know, I always figured Artie Shaw was underrated as a clarinetist because people used to compare him to Benny Goodman, and Benny was the great technician and he could swing, etc. But Artie had passion, and he kept trying new things all the time, like when he had the small group, the Gramercy Five.
Did you go to hear that?
Oh, yeah, I heard him whenever I could. And the one thing about Artie, when I was the New York editor of Downbeat, and he would call once in a while to reprimand me for something I'd written, and I learned that when Artie Shaw was on the phone, that was the end of the afternoon, and I didn't have to do a thing. I just had to listen to the lecture.
Put your feet in the chair and just listen.
That's
yeah,
right.
I know. Well, I remember when you became the editor of Downbeat, that was after you were at the radio station.
Yeah, that was my dream come true because I spent all the nights listening to musicians. Then on the weekends, I would listen to recordings and write about them. And to get to know the musicians, like Ben Webster, for example, a longtime tenor saxophonist with Duke Ellington, he was such an imposing presence, whether he was on the stand or not. And he gave me a lifetime credo. After he left Duke Ellington, much to his regret, because he always said that was the varsity, when he played in it, and this was when I was back in Boston, he'd play around the country, and the local club owners usually couldn't afford his sidemen. So the local guys would sit in, and sometimes they couldn't quite swing the way he did. He would try to lift them up. And we were sitting at a bar at this club between sets, and he'd just been through one of those sets where he couldn't quite lift them up. So he said to me, "You ought to remember this. When the rhythm section ain't making it, go for yourself." And I tell editors that when they want to edit me.
You were talking about Duke before because he spent such a lot of time at the Hickory House. And so did Billy Strayhorn. He would sit at the bar and Duke had his table.
Yes.
And night after night, I would play Duke or Billy Strayhorn tunes. And one of his tunes I wanted to learn, "What Am I Here For?"
Oh, that's one of my favorite tunes. And, you know, it's so seldom played.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it has a beautiful melody. And it always resonates for me because when you think about it, the most fortunate people in the world are those who know why they're here for. And musicians know that, and other people, let's say lawyers who defend the people who need defending. But it was really like Duke. He was a very, you know, he was so urbane.
Wonderful word, Duke.
But he was a very thoughtful man. And my best interviews with him were when I called him on the phone, because then he wasn't on. And he said some very profound things about the history of blacks in this country, the history of music. So "What Am I Here For?" is the epitome of what Ellington was like.
I could play that.
I wish you would. Would have liked that. And hearing you play it reminded me of something I said about you years ago. I was giving a talk on jazz and how some people swing so naturally that if you ask them how to show what it is not to swing, I used to say, well, if you asked Baron McPartlin, show us how not to swing, she couldn't do it.
Hey, that's a nice compliment, but I always felt that I didn't swing, that it took me a long time to learn how, and I'm partly from Mary Lou Williams, because she was the swinger of all time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm having such a good time. We could be here for 2 more hours. I've really had a ball with.
Me too.
So, but we're not going to leave without doing one more tune. Maybe you want to choose one.
Whatever you think embodies the joy of this music, I'll leave it to you.
Well, there's so many. Well, how about This Time the Dream's on Me?
That's going to work out fine.
I hope you're right.
To hear the full Piano Jazz broadcast, tune in next week to your NPR station or stream the program online at pianojazz.npr.org. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina Public Radio.